In this episode, we confront the harsh realities faced by today's younger generation in Canada. Our guest, Dr. Paul Kershaw, brings forth evidence, passion, and a fresh perspective that exposes the true challenges young people encounter. Priced out of home ownership and grappling with the escalating impacts of climate change, young people are often dismissed and overlooked by both the media and in politics. But through Generation Squeeze, Dr. Kershaw's Think and Change Tank, concrete truths about the fiscal inequities affecting younger Canadians are revealed. We explore the stark disparities between the perceptions of seniors and the actual struggles young people face today. Dr. Kershaw talks about how hard work is just not paying off the same way that it used to, and he dives deep into the topics that exemplify the gaps in experiences and opportunities between the generations. Over his decade-long leadership of Generation Squeeze, he's encountered diverse reactions to his analysis of intergenerational fairness, and he shares some surprising aspects of those responses and their impact on fostering dialogue and understanding. Join us as we delve into the work of Dr. Paul Kershaw and Generation Squeeze. I'm Michael Bassett, and this is Bright Future, a Conference Board of Canada podcast. My guest this episode is Dr. Paul Kershaw, an award-winning tenured professor at the University of BC. In addition, Paul is the founder of Generation Squeeze. Paul, welcome to Bright Future.
Thank you so much for having me.
Paul, how did Generation Squeeze get started, and what was your goal behind the creation of this initiative?
Today, my colleagues and I refer to us as Gen Squeeze 3.0. Gen Squeeze 1.0 got started with regards to focusing on family policy. At the time, I was a researcher in something called the Human Early Learning Partnership, and I was really focusing on the pressures on the generation raising young kids. My colleagues and I were picking up that about a third of children were starting in Canada's school system vulnerable in ways that mean that they were more likely to fail, go to jail, or wind up sick as adults. And we're like, why is this happening? And over time, my research started to feel like, wow, we're actually really squeezing the parents raising these young kids economically. And we're slow to invest in them. And so as I was starting to say, why are we slow to invest in them? And I was looking for comparisons, like, where do we invest differently? And it became more and more clear to me that, wow, Canada is actually quite generous in its public investment later in the life course. Many international rankings will have Canada as one of the best places on the planet to be a retiree. But by contrast, we would be ranked as one of the worst industrialized countries in terms of like child poverty. And so I'm like, why is that happening? That got me thinking more and more about generational tensions. And once I saw it with regards to supports between kids and older people, I'm like, oh, I see this in housing. I see this in climate change. And suddenly so many symptoms of issues became clear to me that they're actually the symptoms of an underlying disease, this dysfunctional generational system in Canada. And hence, Generation Squeeze was born.
Is there a story that you tell to help people understand or to drive home the point around why there is this need for a generational lens on Canada's fiscal realities that you find really impactful?
There's three different stories depending on the audience. On the one hand, if I'm talking to a younger person, I'll say, like, the economy is just not rewarding hard work like it used to. A typical young person today will go to school longer, pay more student debt for the privilege, to land jobs that pay thousands of dollars less once you adjust for inflation, to face way higher housing prices that lock them out of home ownership, have more competing for rent, rents are on the rise, and then they delay starting their families. You can only delay so long. And once they do, childcare been another rent size payment, parental leave another mortgage size payment. And that's the private vice grip in which they find themselves. The second story would say, and on top of that private vice grip, we tighten it still further because publicly, younger Canadians are inheriting larger government debts and environmental debts. And then the third story would be looking more to the parents and grandparents of those young people and say, a hard truth I have to share with you is that you play by the rules of the day. You pay taxes according to the rules of the day. But the data are clear now that you didn't pay enough taxes to actually cover the medical care and old age security that your generation is going to want to use. This gets complicated, but to make a long story short, when boomers came of age as young adults, there were nearly 7 working age Canadians for every retiree. But now that boomers are aging and we don't have as many young people falling behind them, there are about 3 workers for every retiree. That demographic shift created a good moment in time for today's baby boomers to pay less during their working age years than is needed to cover the costs they want to now incur through old age security and medical care. That third story is a hard one. That third story sometimes risks people thinking, oh, you're pitting generations against one another. When what I would say is, We're just trying to draw attention to this hard truth that on the watch of today's aging populations, people like my mom and other older members of my family who I love and they love me, on their watch, we let things worsen for their kids and grandchildren. And we play by the rules of the day that were kind of stacked in their favor and against their kids and grandchildren when it came to taxation. It's a hard message to get out, but it's a really important one. Because the punchline would be, if you look at the 2023 federal budget, and we know that the finance minister was wanting to emphasize fiscal restraint as the key theme really driving her budget in 2023, there is no possibility to achieve fiscal restraint without acknowledging the underlying intergenerational tension. And I can make that clear for you because even when we're not in recession over the next 5 years, the federal government's planning $132 billion in deficit financing. 84% of that is going to old age security and additional medical spending on the aging population.
You talk about the difficulty you have in having this conversation sometimes with older generations. Today, the zeitgeist is often captured by memes. There's been this rise in the early 2020s around this OK Boomer meme, where younger generations are really calling out concepts that are totally out of date for today's realities. And it's being seen to draw lines between generations. And that reaction to that OK Boomer meme was for some to see it as quite confrontational. How do you see Generation Squeeze threading this line between calling out the inequities or the different realities while working to build this common understanding or to create change that people will buy into?
That is a common question that we engage with on our own Hard Truths podcast, The Generation Squeeze. And sometimes we get called out for being too focused on love, and other times we get called out for pitting generations against one another. Here's how we try to thread the needle. At the end of the day, the vision is a Canada that works for all generations. So the vision is intergenerational solidarity. And while it can sound corny to talk about the love that will exist around a family table when we come to our next intergenerational holiday moment, it's real. You don't have people coming together around May long weekends coming up for us and people like, I want to screw my kids and grandchildren. No, people really want it to be better for their kids and grandkids than what they had. That's actually a very common sentiment. What we need to do is then bring that common sentiment around the family table into the world of politics and say, but in this space, it's not playing out. The goal then is to draw attention to the tensions, the inequities between generations. Not to pit the generations against one another, but to actually create an opportunity to say there's still time to fix it. And that fixing it really matters for young and old alike. Like a younger demographic really is being harmed by housing unaffordably and climate change and underinvestment in the families raising young kids. They inherit large debts from government, even when we're not in recession. And you need, though, that younger demographic right now to be leaning in to care for our aging parents and grandparents through programs like medical care and old age security. There is an intergenerational contract that matters for public policy. And one thing Gen Squeeze does not want to see is that intergenerational contract erode from younger to older. And I think we need to protect that by saying older to younger, we have let a bit of erosion take place. How can we come to my mom's demographic and say, Mom, I need you to lean back in, because in the public policy world, we aren't achieving what in your family space has been a hallmark of your objectives, and she, in my mom's case, has always delivered. We try and resist the memes. The memes sometimes can be too blunt. They're good for a laugh. And I guess at a certain moment with a younger demographic, we're trying to walk this tightrope of harnessing a constructive frustration or anger and turn it into, let's do something constructive to make the world of politics work better for all the generations. Our big challenge right now is with a younger demographic, there's a great deal of cynicism. The memes lead to cynicism, not to leaning into fixing the broken system. And that cynicism in politics is one of the key reasons at Gen Squeeze. We say, like, we're in the business of needing to rejuvenate democracy, like restore a bit of trust in our democratic processes, because no individual really can work their way out of a broken system. Maybe a few occasionally can, but generally speaking, you fix systems through the systemic level, which is through politics. And so the distaste that so many now have for politics is such a barrier to solving big problems like housing unaffordability, climate change, investing in families with young kids, debts, and so on.
In our earlier conversation before the podcast, you contrasted the traditional perception of the frail and vulnerable pensioner with this vulnerability you see for young people in your analysis. Maybe you could elaborate on that example a little bit for us, but then also use it to connect in those dots around the kinds of topics that you are seeing that really exemplify why the younger generation are the ones that are vulnerable.
Yeah, so what an interesting segue from the meme to what we're now talking about is cultural myths. And cultural myths are so much more powerful than the provocative meme, which is funny. To be clear, there'd be good reason to describe our aging population as experiencing vulnerability from the human life course perspective. Of course, as we age, we become more biologically frail. That's why we are going to use much, much more of our medical care when we are older, and why there are these age implications to medical care spending. And we expect that. We will never spend equal amounts on a younger person and an older person for the very reason that we have a biological frailty that comes more and more as we age. But biological frailty is only one kind of vulnerability. We tend to presume in this country that seniors are economically vulnerable. And I can see that in so many spaces politically, whether it was the Federal Liberal Convention and their most recent efforts to focus on let's reduce poverty for seniors, which is a lovely ambition. But we should also acknowledge that no matter how Stats Can describes poverty, seniors have the lowest rates of any age group in the country. If you think about who has the most wealth in the country, it's also going to be the case that an older demographic has the most wealth. And not only that, today's older population has more wealth by comparison with previous older generations. Economic vulnerability has absolutely shifted from older to younger. And that is one of the key reasons why hard work doesn't pay off for younger people like it used to. And what's vexing in this shift from vulnerability from older to younger is that what is harming a younger demographic is being tacitly permitted because it's been benefiting those who are older. Housing's really at the epicenter of this, and every one of your listeners will be familiar with the idea that home prices have left earnings behind by comparison with previous decades. When my mom started out in the housing market in around 1976, it took the typical young adult 5 years of full-time work to save a 20% down payment on an average-priced home in this country. That was the case in Metro Vancouver, where my mom was, in the GTA, BC, and Ontario, and across the country. It was all around 5 to 6 years. But if you flash forward to today, it's now 17 years, 22 in BC and Ontario, 27 in Metro Vancouver and the GTA. That is a massive erosion in the way that hard work pays off for a younger demographic in terms of covering the major costs of living. And yet it hasn't created that big a backlash in the world of politics because rising home prices have not been uniformly bad. They've also made people much, much more wealthy. I know of what I speak in the last 5 years alone, and you know, I'm no longer in the Gen Squeeze demographic that I started. I'm now over 45, I'm 48. But I've gained $1 million in the last 4 years in my home. Well, I slept, watched television. That's more than the average price of a home in the entire country. There can become a cultural addiction to high and rising home prices because it gives us easy wealth. It gives us what I would describe as lazy economic growth. We've become accustomed to that, but not done enough to recognize, wow, is it causing harm for those who follow in our footsteps, whether they're younger generations we love or the newcomers of any age who we are welcoming to this country, increasingly in record numbers.
Is this intergenerational issue, does it apply across the whole country? Is it a coast-to-coast-to-coast issue? Are there parts where it is particularly acute?
The reality of hard work not paying off like it used to in terms of what's required in particular to cover a major cost of living is a coast-to-coast-to-coast issue. It is absolutely the case that hard work is paying off less now in Ontario and BC by comparison with other provinces. That's not to discount the challenges that are happening in Halifax and Calgary and Montreal, but those two provinces have in particular relied on real estate to grow their GDP and have tolerated what I would now describe as an insane gap between home prices and earnings. There is variation, but I would strongly resist the idea and discourage anyone from thinking this is just a Toronto problem or just a Vancouver problem. I can talk about what's happening in Nelson, BC, which I think has a population of less than 10,000. I can talk about what's happening in any range of cities in Ontario. This is in London. This is in Hamilton. Hamilton, you know, it was like a Rust Belt city for so long. And now has it experienced some of the greatest wealth accumulation in housing, and as a result, some of the greatest unaffordability that you'll see anywhere in the country. This is pervasive. And that's what's so discouraging about what the pandemic unleashed in some regards. The pandemic was a moment where there was a contagious virus spreading from coast to coast to coast. And as people were social distancing and we disconnected somewhat from the bricks and mortar buildings where we were working. And that then allowed us to have new opportunities to move further from our places of employment, hand in hand with exceptionally low rates of interest. We then started spreading the contagion of housing unaffordability as people were taking their equity from wherever they were, going elsewhere that was more affordable because they could be further from where they worked, and then bidding up the prices of homes in these, at that moment, less expensive places. And you can see, you know, that's in particular when the province of Ontario, over a two-year period, suffered a greater erosion of affordability and or a greater accumulation of housing wealth over a two-year period that we've seen anywhere in the country at any time in the last half century. And then it spread even further to Atlantic Canada. We're kind of repopulating Atlantic Canada in important ways. But that is then starting to create new housing pressures out in Atlantic Canada. And the rents in some of our territories are alarming. NWT's rents can rival what you would see in some of the biggest urban centers.
In over a decade of leading this work, what has surprised you the most about the reaction that you're getting to this analysis that you're bringing to this intergenerational issue?
Well, at first, I was surprised that when we described differences between older and younger people, we were sometimes described then as pitting the generations against one another. I didn't expect that. I'm like, well, we can describe differences between men and women and talk about a gender gap or a sex gap. We talk about it all the time in terms of pay equity. People aren't saying that that analysis is pitting generations against one another. The economy and culture is pitting generations against one another. We draw attention to it so we can fix it. Same, you know, whether we're doing a racialized analysis or we're thinking about the legacy of colonization, drawing attention to these comparisons is necessary for overcoming the problem. But when we started with Gen Squeeze, our shining a light on these gaps between young and old and different generations was the power of culture to discredit us by suggesting that we were being mean and pitting generations against one another. What I'm excited about now is we seem to be at a moment where I don't think we've crossed the tipping point, but where there is more openness to the conversation. And I will flag that in the lead up to the federal budget, the Globe and Mail was running a week-long series on like what to look at in the 2023 budget. And I was delighted and maybe almost fell off my chair at my desk when I saw that their first article was, wow, we have to address the generational gap in the budget. This is now not just Gen Squeeze as a small but mighty think and change tank based at the University of BC with our charitable partner, the Association for Generational Equity, saying that now we do have mainstream editorial boards embracing this as their first observation about a federal budget. And I anticipate that we can bring that down to a level of provincial budgets. And so I think there's a moment now where I'm hopeful as we have different provincial and federal governments create the mandate letters for their ministers. In the not so distant future, we're going to see mandate letters for a particular minister say, you now have responsibility for generational fairness and bringing that lens to kind of all of government activity. And that becomes so critical for our institutionalizing the commitment to reduce these generational tensions like gender-based analysis plus does for racism and sexism and classism and colonialism.
I'm going to ask you to respond to, I think you're going to find these easy to swat down, but I'm going to ask you to respond to some of those standard challenges around why these things are the way they are. First one is around voting. StatsCan analysis of voter turnout over the last 10 years consistently shows that over 80% of folks who are 55 plus, they show up and vote. But that percentage of voters declines as the cohort gets younger. Only 66% of 18 to 24 year olds voted in the 2021 election. Do you think that voter turnout is behind the lack of attention that's being paid to issues that are impacting younger people versus older people?
Absolutely. I'm not going to debunk that. That is bang on. Politics responds to those who organize and show up. One of the most important moments of showing up is on ballot day and casting a vote. I don't care who you cast a vote for, but the fact that a younger demographic is less likely to cast a vote is one of the reasons why there remains this systemic momentum to maintain the current dysfunctional generational system. And I can tell you, I have sat in many meetings with provincial and federal elected members of parliament and legislatures who have said, well, part of our problem is we need to win elections, and the demographic that is suffering this inequality is less likely to vote. Part of the reason why Gen Squeeze, if you go to what we do, that part of the tab on our website, welcome you to gensqueeze.ca, the top thing we'll say, we're in the business of rejuvenating democracy. Right now, there's an election on in Alberta, and we do what we call our voter's guide, a nonpartisan, evidence-based voter's guide. I don't care how people vote. We want to give them a kind of one-stop shop. If you want to cut through the noise of all these promises about housing or families or the climate or government deficits or healthcare, come here and we'll help you cut through the noise. How you use that information is great, but we hope that that information will make people feel more confident to go to the ballot box and not simply say, eh, it doesn't matter, they're all the same. It also, though, does behoove that older demographic that is more likely to cast a ballot. Those mums and dads, those grandmas and grandpas, aunts and uncles, to be open to not only voting for their life course moment, but for the legacy they want to leave. And I think at this moment, I really have to plead with our aging population to think deeply about all of the signs that on their watch, things have deteriorated in important ways. This isn't to lay blame or shame, but to say there's still time to try and fix it. I don't know any person who's later in their life who hasn't had as their goal, I want it to be better for my younger family members than it was for me. And unfortunately, that's not what the data show about the world we're leaving for younger Canadians. I need that older demographic as they vote more to help compensate for the fact that their kids aren't voting as much. So to have both their legacy and their current needs in mind. And also, you know, light a fire under those kids and grandchildren. Tell them that voting matters and help us get them out.
So the other side of that question, and you talked about legacy, is the question of wealth and wealth benefits and transfers. While the wealth and benefits are being amassed by this generation right now, they can't take that with them when they go, to be a bit crass. It's estimated that about $1 trillion are going to be transferred from the baby boomer generation to other generations. What do you then say to those who advocate, well, let's be patient. When we're done, that money will go and we'll have that available to the next generations. And they preach patience for today's generations to wait for this windfall.
Let's imagine that that $1 trillion is going to be distributed to a range of generations that follow in the footsteps of our aging population. If that is the case, then what we have is a problem of the wealth transfers out of step with the needs in our life course. We know, bringing it back to where we started from research at the Human Early Learning Partnership, that as a species, human beings are especially sensitive to our environments when we are young, well before we get to kindergarten. Literally, our genes are waiting to respond to the environments that they're experiencing. And if they experience an environment that is safe and nurturing, they'll like, oh, okay, it'll optimize for that. And it will say the world's going to be a safe and nurturing kind of place. But if they're finding a lot of stress, then our genes are going to respond to like, this is a stressful environment. And that will have lifelong implications for our health and well-being, for our immune system, our biology, and it literally is going to set us up to be more vulnerable over our lives. If we have people who are living into their mid-80s, and they're going to pass their wealth down, then people are going to inherit it in their mid-50s. Those people's kids are going to be in their 20s, and you need those kids to be supported when they were raising 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5-year-olds. We need public policy right now to adapt to the mismatch between the intergenerational transfer wealth within families and the beautiful thing that we live longer now than we used to. As a result of that, we have to figure out how to, at a public level, direct more wealth transfer early into the life course of the generation raising young kids. And we're also going to need to recognize baby boomers who worked hard throughout their lives, did great work to raise their kids, supporting their grandchildren now, but the rules of the day while they were working did not ask them to pay enough in taxes to cover the costs of the medical care they now need to use and the old age security on which they wish to rely. Some of your listeners may be angry at me for saying that. We need to have them think about some of what the more affluent members of the aging population ought to be contributing in taxation right now to cover the costs of their generational cohort's needs for old age security and medical care so that we don't leave large unpaid bills for their kids and grandchildren, and so that we don't leave such constrained fiscal circumstances that our governments can't urgently enough invest to implement childcare as much as we need for $10 a day childcare, or to invest in post-secondary more, or to green the economy, or to address a number of risks that have really shifted towards younger people. We need that wealth transfer to be thought about getting it earlier in the life course for the generation raising young kids, asking the more affluent members of the older demographic right now to make sure that their generational cohort is on average paying for what it wants to use and not leaving bails unpaid for their kids and grandkids.
Paul, you've called Generation Squeeze the Think and Change organization.
A think tank is pretty common. We're like, I just don't want to give you good ideas. We're going to invite you to work with us to change the system. That's what's behind the Think and Change tank.
What does it mean in terms of how you think about your work and how you think about the work of the organization?
I mean, this really reflects how I understand my role as a scholar at a prominent university in this country. I think in the academy, we've often hoped that evidence would be enough to sway public policy. Would evidence be enough to change people's behavior, let alone sway public policy? But political science for literally centuries does point out to all of us that evidence is but one factor that influences our public policy decisions. Evidence will be competing with a range of value systems, ideological predilections, the momentum of existing institutions, competing interest groups. Political science say, if you want to understand how you shape public policy, you got to engage in all of that. That's why Gen Squeeze is a think and change tank. And so we take pride in having a lab at the University of British Columbia, governed by the academic practices of needing to provide rigorous research as peer-reviewed, etc. But then not just be content with putting it out there and hoping someone's going to find it and act on it. We then go and we do what academic funding bodies now call knowledge translation or knowledge mobilization, is how the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council describes it. We really bring a robust thinking about it. I think we're particularly good at it. So here's our six steps for doing it. First, when we create the evidence, our first step is to then make meaning of it for people in the light of their values. Values generally in Canada, and also thinking about different, if you're sort of a right of center person, how might we frame it for it? If you're a left of center person, how might we frame it for it? So making it light of people's values, because the values drive whether people lean in or lean away from the evidence. As we're making meaning from the evidence in light of people's values, we're really then trying to frame people's beliefs about what are the problems of the day and what are the solutions. And as we're framing people's beliefs, then we're hoping that we're shaping public opinion broadly, because as public opinion shifts in a direction, that creates a political cover for politicians to courageously act. And as we're creating some of that political cover and we frame people's beliefs, okay, we can't do everything all at once, so here's an agenda for right now. Set in a concrete agenda, some with really concrete policy asks, and then build up a coalition of organizations and individuals like, yeah, I want that right now. And once we've made meaning of the evidence in light of the people's opinion, shaped people's values, shaped their opinion, framed beliefs about solutions and problems, created that agenda, and then built a coalition around it, we can marshal all of that to change the incentives to which politicians respond, because politics respond to those who organize and show up. That is what we're trying to do. It's one of the reasons why, if you do go to gensqueeze.ca, you'll see a button toward the top right that says join. It may sound like an unimportant action, but the power of our organization, the power of our alliance, which is over 40,000 strong now, the power of that group grows with the size of the network. Our ability to go and attract attention, show hardworking elected officials of all party stripes that we represent a constituency. Constituency that can matter for their ability to say, we're responding to that group, or maybe make a difference. That's a kind of influence that matters for helping evidence to wind its way through all the power dynamics and win the day, so that we govern not in the light of fake news, but govern in the light of the best evidence provided by the Academy here in Canada and elsewhere.
And is there one thing or a set of specific recommendations that you think is going to have the greatest impact on bringing an intergenerational lens to our policy and fiscal situation?
Yeah, so I'm going to answer it in two ways. A high-level way about framing is going to have a big impact, and then you're looking for some of the concrete policy wins. So at a framing level, I really do believe we're getting close to people recognizing that housing unaffordability, climate change, challenges for families with kids, and government debts, these are all symptoms of the same underlying disease, generational unfairness. So housing unaffordability is the outcome of, we've extracted so much wealth from our housing system, we leave little affordability left over for those who follow. Climate change, we've extracted so much of the atmosphere's scarce capacity to absorb carbon that we leave less of it left over, and extreme weather is our legacy. In terms of underinvesting in generation raising young kids, extracting so many of today's tax dollars from economic growth to invest later in the life course, that we leave less of it left over to invest in younger demographics. And then that gives rise oftentimes to spending more resources than we're bringing in through tax dollars and extracting that good stuff and leaving unpaid bills for those who follow. There's a common extraction theme and leaving less of the good stuff left over. I hope that we can have people see those connections. I just described huge policy areas for which there are many policy details, but that framing matters. And then in terms of policy victories, well, we take great pride in $10 a day childcare. The framing for a national recommendation around $10 a day childcare started in the Jen Squeeze lab. It was then taken on by the great coalition of childcare advocates and early educators of BC, creating a movement in BC. That movement influenced national narratives. And it is not a coincidence that the 2021 federal budget framed its recommendation around childcare about as $10 a day. That was the biggest investment in social policy in a generation. I hadn't seen anything that big in my entire professional career. So we're really excited about that. We did have success at changing early drafts of the National Housing Strategy. That came out in 2017. Early drafts did not identify young adults as being vulnerable in the housing market. It identified seniors being vulnerable, which was ironic because seniors are more likely to be homeowners than almost any other group, and they had the most wealth than housing. But they were vulnerable. Young people were not. And we eventually, the last moment, talk about 11th hour, did get young people into the list of groups that were vulnerable in the housing market, which then made them eligible for billions of dollars of spending from the National Housing Strategy. Going forward, we're at a moment where Canada is going to need to come to terms with health doesn't begin with medical care. We are really worried right now about spending more and more on medicine, but I can show you that there was a time some decades ago when we spent more on social and educational issues than we did on medicine. Decades later, we do the exact reverse. But that's not what health science would tell us. Health science would tell us that we need to invest where health begins. That's in our neighborhoods, our childcare settings, our schools, a healthy climate. Once you've got to your doctor's office or the emergency room, the hospital, then we're now dealing with illness. We're treating illness, but we're not necessarily promoting well-being. Canadians really need to wrestle with that. And Jen Squeeze is on a mission with the Get Well Canada Alliance to have governments increasingly more urgently invest where health begins to promote well-being and not simply treat illness after we fall sick. And I think the most controversial one, but I see that we're slowly but surely getting there. We do a lot of raising of taxes in this country by taxing income. And it's interesting because in some regards, we want more income, especially for middle and lower earners. So we're taxing something we want more of quite a lot. We tax less often things that we want less of more lightly. And so I think about pollution. We've moved into pricing pollution. But I also think housing unaffordability, you know, high value homes, high housing prices, those things are harmful in many regards. We don't really want home prices to keep rising, but we shelter housing from taxation like we don't shelter any other asset. It's been a controversial theme for us to be pushing on, but I see some inevitability as governments more and more are going to need to come up with dollars to address the fiscal requests of our aging population for more medical care and old age security. And we won't only be able to run deficits. And so one space to collect that will be by tapping into the housing wealth of the more affluent part of our aging population. And that will then allow us a tax shift to tax incomes less, especially for middle and lower earner individuals, and tax housing wealth more, especially for those like me, lucky enough to own a home that's worth more than $1 million. You probably will have some listeners who are scoffing at that. We haven't won the day on that one, but I started with $10 a day childcare. When I first was going on to radio programs in 2010, when we started talking in that way, I'd get laughed, I'd get critiqued, I'd get angry people calling in and saying I was an idiot. Now I can go on the radio and like, yeah, everyone, like, that makes sense. I think that we are partway through that process with regards to a tax shift to tax housing wealth inequality, a price on housing inequity. I think that'll become more and more of a norm so that we can reduce taxes on renters and middle and lower earners more generally.
Paul, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. I'm really glad we have this opportunity to connect. It's such an interesting analysis. I know Compass Board has collaborated with you on some of the work and asked similar questions in terms of getting clarity on how the impacts are actually rolling out across generations as we look about our forecast. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It's my pleasure. And let me tip my hat to the Conference Board of Canada for the important work that you and your colleagues are doing. And we draw on it regularly at Jen Squeeze and really look to your team members to be giving a voice for what's the economy that we need going forward so that we have a vibrant economy, which gives rise to a vibrant society and the social policies that are really important for Generation Squeeze.
You've been listening to Bright Future from the Conference Board of Canada. If you like what you hear, you can leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Let us know how we're doing. The views expressed by our guests are theirs alone and do not reflect the Conference Board's research or opinion. For more podcasts, research, commentary, and ideas, visit conferenceboard.ca.